Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. Some early birds. I appreciate all the responses that you've sent. What I'd like to propose is that we have more of an open mic discussion at the end of our fourth seminar where we can have more of an exchange. There are some responses that I've received that I would really like everyone in the group to have exposure to, and I'd like to maybe ask the ones of you who have sent some commentary and some responses to, if you can, stick around after the top of the hour in our fourth seminar to have just a discussion and to share some of your ideas, and then also to ask if there are things that we haven't covered or if the things you'd like to discuss a bit further to do that. But for right now, thoughts, questions, anything you want to add or ask. And I really appreciate all the commentary, the kind words, and the responses and questions you've sent in. We could have a whole seminar series just on your responses, so I'm very grateful. Anything from anyone before we officially start and while we're just in a discussion mode? And thank you for managing.
Hey, David, this is Doug Filter.
Please, go ahead.
I sent you a quick email a little while just before the class started. I know these classes are recorded. Are they going to be available on the Coach Training Alliance training site so we can go back and listen to them again?
Yes. The link that you got that was actually two links, one to download the outline and one for the recordings, that will be up for approximately a year. So, yes, absolutely,
perfect.
It will stand so that you can do
Thank
that.
You.
Can I get a management of the background noise? Your discussion is being picked up. I welcome discussions, questions, thoughts, if you'll manage the background noise so that we don't have to until I go to lecture mode in just a couple of moments. So, thanks for that. Other thoughts or questions or things you'd like to add or ask? Let me offer, then, one response to the question that I added. How can you get someone to change? And I wanted to go back in time a little over 700 years. This is from Blaise Pascal, a French mathematician and philosopher, who gave, this is a close rendition of his answer, not an exact quote. People are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they have themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others. So Pascal's answer was simply, don't tell them to change. Evoke the reasons for change that are already in their mind and brain and highlight those, support those. This is what motivates people to make a shift without resistance. So think about how we do that, how you do that every day as a mentor coach. You ask open-ended questions. You have empathic resonance with the experience of someone, reflective listening, and summarizing or reflecting the open-ended question so that someone feels understood and wants to further engage. So what we do then is engage someone's own development of their story, not asking them to subscribe to our story or let us ghostwrite their story. So this is a beginning of what we're looking at with change and transition, because it begins with the person. Because the fastest way to foreclose change or exploration is to tell somebody an answer. If you don't believe that, try it with the closest and first adolescent you run into. You don't need to wait for your client tomorrow. Any other thoughts or things you want to add or ask before we move into our what we're supposed to be talking about here? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise, and we'll come back and have discussion at the end. Okay, we're going to talk about how to change mind, brain, and behavior. And these are some fundamental aspects that incorporate the mind, brain, and performance sciences, which I think are some of the most useful aspects to help and inform us in mentor coaching. And the questions I'm asking are in the outline. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they really know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, even sometimes doing it harder, and expect a different result? It's kind of like if someone doesn't understand English, you repeat it a little bit louder, as if that's going to work. Even when it leads to lower energy, death, plateaued careers, disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asked this question in a different way in The Black Swan. What are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer, I want to answer that question, why we resist change, in two parts. Part of the answer of why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. Now, a comfort zone may be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness. On the other hand, a new story generates uncertainty, even trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they may not feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, an internal map that's synonymous with identity. So we tend to return to our default mode. Do a brief exercise. Put your palms together and firmly interlock your fingers. Now, notice with your hands firmly clasped which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly clasped, but shift so that the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? A little goofy, a little awkward? Now, move your thumbs back to the original place. Ah, kind of a relief. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or even derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. So we're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to use them to program change. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That dialectic is always in place. So the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns. He noticed that each person followed the same path that he walked. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn despite it being circuitous, very indirect. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. So he repeated this every time it snowed, no matter how many twists and turns, and he got increasingly diabolical with this. Each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, and they become the default mode. You don't even think about it. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight may be a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. the catalyst for insight? A novel stimulus, new information, or new context, a mentor coach who asks a question that the client has not asked himself or herself. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engaging new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be perhaps mistakenly read as evidence not to proceed, a gut feeling that you made the wrong decision, or intuition that it's a wrong choice. This is all from the discomfort simply of taking one step in a new and previously not experienced direction. Or, remember we talked initially about how framing can be important. If it's framed as excitement, as opportunity, as challenge, then you proceed as opposed to interpreting it as danger, better head for cover, or your intuition is telling you this is not right. So this is where we also resonate with the experience of our clients as coaches, because every step in a new and different direction, every step of change is going to have a companion experience of trepidation, uncertainty, or just simply not knowing what it's going to be. And the person then has to choose whether to stay with that or return to the familiar. So we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change actually are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. So every time we do something new or different, our brain, our error detection mechanism in our brain says, this isn't normal. Every change, every transition will read as this kind of disquieting, not what we expected kind of reading. So I want to discuss in this section what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients, regulating states of mind. Never more important than at a time of change and transition. So let's look at understanding what a state of mind is. It's really like a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we proceed and process information and how we respond. Each state of mind is its own software. Particular emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element in mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of the process of how grounded and centered they are, how they choose what state will work best in what circumstance. An example, if you're creatively writing, you get in that state and that will really support what you're doing. Editing, a totally different part of your brain, a different time, not to be confined or going back and forth. Here's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. You may remember this from college. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the goal, to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if before you teach the rat to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, just enough to alter its state, then teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain the information about how to get to the cheese. Now, you re-inject just that little bit of amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning, state-dependent memory. So this is an example of two distinct states of mind. And this is more like post-traumatic stress disorder. But a more common example is think about when you've tried to think of somebody's name and you can't. You know it's on the tip of your tongue. You know what it is, but you just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state of mind or when you're doing something else, boom, you get the name. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program, that determines how we perceive and how we process information as well as respond. So each of us has a range of states and often some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even how to enter and exit different states. It's also important to become aware of which state works best for what kind of purpose. And an example would be from the alertness and focused attention of business or when you're about to do a presentation versus being relaxed and able to go to sleep more effectively. Different states of mind. So it's also important for us as mentor coaches to be able to resonate with that mind-body state of the client to understand their subjective experience as well as the story that they communicate. So here's something just to think about. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right-brain to right-brain communication of coach and clients. And we respond when we're really grounded and centered, also in an intuitive and automatic way in this flow state. And this is very much like the deliberate practice of any kind of performance. Think about a skill set, whether it's the artist or the athlete, into a specific state of mind with deliberate practice to develop the performance, to develop it so that it's an automatic flow. This is what you've experienced when you've been totally grounded and centered and immersed in the story, the resonance of the experience of your client, and totally focused on their story so that you're in that flow. An example of how you can break that flow is to think about what question you should ask next or what might work better here. Yogi Berra put it very simply, you can't think and hit at the same time. So that flow and the immersion in that flow is important, and it's really an alignment with the story development by the client and us as a catalyst for that. So we do this as part of deep listening, an attention that simultaneously at multiple levels, the way of thinking, a way of experiencing combined. It's really the art and the science of mentor coaching, and it's based on our being grounded, centered, and totally attuned to the client, which is also going to be a model of the client doing that more effectively. So rarely we'll have to address that in a more formal way, such as if a client has had a really upsetting time and comes to the session. Mention a couple of examples of times when a client has called at their regular time, and each time, you know, they had a really upsetting, preoccupying experience, so they just wanted to call to reschedule for a later time. And I ask in both of these instances, they were very different, but similar for this discussion, I ask if they would spend just a minute to do, in one instance, a grounding and centering exercise, a progressive relaxation, and another, a mindfulness meditation. And when they did that, and each took about a minute, they were totally engaged, continued with the session. And my belief is that what happened in that first minute really was a model that was the most important thing that happened the entire session. Think about how when you do, let's say, a mindfulness meditation, how that's a model of focus. That's the first question we ask a client, what would you like to focus on Where would you like to get to? And we help a client focus and pick the next thing. Yeah, there's so many things. What would the next thing be? So this is a model of focus and of effectiveness, because in mindfulness meditation, as you probably know, you're focusing on relaxation of your body and just on your breath of breathing in and breathing out. If you have a thought, which you inevitably will, it's the job description of the brain to activate and have thoughts. If you have a thought, you simply let it go. If you're a visual organizer, you just let it float away like a cloud. You don't engage it and refocus on your breath. This is a model for focus and effectiveness that can be very useful in our work with clients and very useful for clients. So what do you think these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the crucial success strategy of managing their states of mind, of self-regulation. To use drugs, alcohol, any other addictive substance or process or person to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. You can be basically addicted to anything. An addiction is when a behavior becomes the central organizing factor of your life. So the state of mind determines the meaning we attach to something. The meaning determines the behavior. So by changing the state of mind, we change the behavior. Now, there are a couple of basic ways to regulate your state of mind. Focus and physiology. Focus is exactly as we talked about in a mindfulness meditation, of specifically focusing on something which has a very important regulatory effect, and physiology, which is simply being aware of breathing. So these are basically things that help us to focus, and then with our clients to create a systematic way of going about addressing a specific issue. So the best way to do that, one of the best ways to do this, is simply ask a question. That focuses attention. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen many years ago to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO of Apple at that time. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City. Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or you want to change the world? So here's an exercise I'd suggest you do. Just jot it down now, because you may want to give a little bit more than just passing attention to this exercise. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state. In the morning, answer those three empowering questions and feel the answer. Now, you're already asking yourselves questions. As you wake up, before you turn on the bedside lamp, before your feet ever touch the floor, you're always asking questions. I'll give you an example in just a minute. This just orchestrates the focus to consciously engineer to the questions that empower you. One of my buddies who does a Vistage group, and you probably know those are business mastermind groups where they have like CEOs and business owners that meet in a mastermind format once a month for an entire day. And she was telling me that two of her Vistage group members both had a very disconcerting happening at each of their businesses. In both instances, there was a major accident, and in one, people got injured, another, someone got killed, and they were still in the aftermath of this months later. It was still kind of a toxic presence. They had not gotten over it. So she asked me if I would come and do a workshop on stress management. So here's the essence of the thing that I did that worked. I'm going to spare you guys 3 hours, okay? I ask each of them what questions they ask themselves when they woke up in the morning. And each of them talked about, you know, what can go wrong today? Is it going to be, do I need to get legal involved? All the negative stuff. The first thing we think about establishes the mindset, the state of mind that we engage and then process the rest of the day. Think about how if you get up, you stub your toe. Well, you've got about 3 bad hours coming up because you've had a lousy awakening and state of mind. So I recommended that each of them, and this included the two people who were having major troubles, that they each think of 3 empowering questions, just as I mentioned, to write down sometime the day before and have at their bedside to answer these before they ever got out of bed and to see what it did. I gave them some examples of what could be empowering questions, what would put them in a positive state of mind. Well, my buddy called me about a week after we did this, and she said both of the people who were having such a major difficulty noticed an immediate turnaround that affected not only them, but management, and it had a trickle-down effect that people were creating more of an effective and engaged atmosphere like they had done before. So this is how powerful a mindset can be, because a mindset boots up the software that engages the entire rest of the process, including behavior. Remember the very first of our last seminar, we talked about how one of the things we do in coaching is to help our clients create a framework that is adaptive and suitable to them. And I remember I gave the example of our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. How you frame it determines how you're going to proceed and how it follows. So here's an example of more actively determining that. Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, inherited a team. When he arrived, his team was 217 out of 217 in his division nationwide for free throw percentage, the lowest they could possibly be. So first thing Reed did during practice, he had his players develop a mantra as they practiced the free throw. Before they shot the free throw, before they practiced the free throw, he had them do 3 things. To create a focus phrase, such as relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized that each of them do their own. And then at the same time that they were saying this phrase, to focus the energy field of their brain, they would take a deep breath in for relaxation and breathe out any tension. And the cue to doing both of these was to dribble twice. So they would dribble twice, have the focus, say the focus phrase to themselves while they were taking a deep breath. So this took 3 to 4 seconds, just the time that it took to dribble twice. Additionally, during practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle and have them go to the free shot line and do 2 practice free throws. If they made them, they got to take a break. If not, they took 4 laps as a team, because in a game, you don't get to, you know, line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best. you're playing, you're tired, you're fouled, you probably have some emotional reactions. So it's about self-regulation as well as practicing in this very deliberate way. So 2 years later, the team was ranked number one in their division nationwide. Now, what we can learn from that? A mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology. You can do that anytime you want to get grounded and centered. I do that before I receive a call from a mentor coaching client, before I start talking to you guys. What you'll notice is, and here's a resource that I want to offer you because we don't have time to as fully discuss this as we might. On my homepage of MentorPath, M-E-N-T-O-R-P-A-T-H, at the very bottom thing on the homepage is a link for a free webinar on Master States of Mind. It's about 30, 35 minutes. And you'll hear a little bit more elaboration on what we're talking about now, a cue, a focus, a physiology. So ultimately, when you do this over time, simply the cue will instantly get you in that grounded and centered state, like before a presentation. I would, put my index finger and thumb together on both hands and touch them like a little infinity symbol, and then do a couple of deep breaths and then a focus phrase, relaxed and powerful. And you want to be sure your focus phrase fits with what you're doing. When you're trying to go to sleep, you don't want to be relaxed and powerful. You want to relax to sleep. So ultimately, I think what you'll find is that this rewires your brain. So right now, all I need to do is touch one index finger and one thumb, and boom, I'm ready to go with whatever I do. I gave a presentation 2 days ago at my medical school reunion. It's exactly what I did to get ready instantly to talk to my buddies. So this is basically neural conditioning. To think positively is not enough. This is a system. It's kind of a microsystem, but it's a system. Remember when we talked initially that if you really want to help someone create change, focus not just on the goal, but focus on the system. This is what we do in coaching. We help a client frame the discussion and then focus on a system to pursue the attainment of that. So these are the things that I think can create links inside your head, the meaning you give that determines your behavior. And a neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotions to whatever's happening around you. So let's talk about an example of this. There are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. So at any moment, we're having a dialectic between these two forces, wanting to avoid pain and wanting to gain pleasure. So think about your client who knows exactly what needs to be done, has a plan, but then at the time that the trigger for the plan would get underway, decided to procrastinate. Maybe did an internal bargaining of, say, well, I'm going to do it next Tuesday. Or maybe defied their own authorities. Ah, the hell with it. I'm going to do what I enjoy. Or maybe just got scattered. So this is something that we might be helping to explore. At the very instant that you decided not to go with your plan, what was your thought? So this is the first thing we want to know. Did you have a plan, and did you stick to it? And we touched before, you don't need to be motivated. All you need is a plan and stick to it. So the first question we have is, Coach, did you have a plan? So when you got to that plan and took and were ready to take one step to do it, what was your internal conversation? Let's say that you're not doing something you want or need to do. Somehow, you likely associate pain with doing it, and you avoid pain. So it's not that you're trying to sabotage yourself, but you're avoiding some kind of pain. So, for example, if somebody wants to make more money, or save money, or in some way generate a plan to create wealth and make money, that's a conscious, logical focus. The greater pleasure would be in following through, but now somebody stops themselves. And here's the shadow story that makes it make sense. Well, all this effort it would take, I'm just as comfortable where I am. Maybe I'd have to take advantage of people. Or people are going to judge me and I'll be ostracized. I'll be lonely at the top. I don't think I really got what it takes. Whatever that shadow story is, if it goes in the opposite direction of the logical, conscious pursuit of pleasure, such as I want to generate more income and create wealth, then there's a stuckness. So this, and one question that we can ask as coaches, following these twin motivations of avoiding pain and pursuing pleasure, what will the pain be if you do this, is the question. What we may ask as coaches is, what will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the pleasure if you do? So we're helping someone look beyond a conscious motivation to look at and consider the natural consequences of their action. We're defined by the stories we tell ourselves. So we want to know, is your story empowering you or helping you to stop and avoid pain and end any discomfort, but also putting a real glass ceiling on possibility? So most people are stuck because of the story that they tell themselves. And that story may have come from some time ago or be one simply they want to believe. Remember, the thing that most often keeps you from getting what you want may be the story that you tell yourself about why you can't have it. So this is about regulation and management of state of mind. State always comes first, before strategy and story. Because state determines the mindset that's booted up to deal with something. In the example I gave of the couple of clients who we did a mindfulness meditation or relaxation, the other example from the Vistage groups, the first order of business was to determine a state of mind which would allow full engagement of full possibility in the present moment, so that then someone can identify what they want to change. So here are some questions. Let's reduce this to some key principles. How do you condition yourself to make changes that last? So if we kind of oversimplify it, but if we simplify it to three steps. One, identify what to change. So you need to get to the point where you feel like something really needs change. You must change. You must change it now. And that not changing would ultimately be more painful than the immediate discomfort of change itself. So change is linked with pleasure. So here are some questions for this first step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to your current choice that may be adaptive in some ways, at least in your mind? And also, what will be the pleasure with changing? What are the possibilities? Secondly, you have to interrupt the existing pattern. You can't just add something on to what's already there, like adding a health club membership. You have to interrupt a pattern if it's not creating exactly what you want, to recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. So here are a couple of questions. What are the cues or the triggers for your automatic response, your automatic pattern? And then think of ways to interrupt that pattern once you've identified it. Now, some examples that you'll hear on the Master States of Mind are emotional triggers that can instantly create a state of mind that you're in a time capsule. The I think I gave the example in that webinar from my website of the first client I worked with to initially hatch the idea of the neuroconditioning chart about how there can be an emotional trigger that instantly puts someone in a state of mind that is from a long time ago, but it's like a time capsule, and a time capsule never changes. So you can't therapize your way, you can't figure your way out of it or reason or logic your way out of it. You have to regulate your state of mind. And that webinar will offer a bit more detail about how to do this. And the third step is simply create a new association that empowers you. Think about the things you'll gain, the pleasure you'll have with the change, or at least the results of the change. So you create an empowering association. It may be, as you'll hear if you have a chance to go to the website in that webinar, you'll hear how you can simply create a new association and an ideal behavior using the same trigger. And that's, when you do that enough, it changes your brain. That's the neural association change. So look at what you want to bring about in terms of change and think of the things that you gain and the pleasure you'll have with your change. Probably the most familiar story, and I mention it because I know you guys are familiar with it. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in that concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death as everyone around him, he observed that about one out of every 25 of his fellow prisoners managed to survive. He studied them and studied what was different about them. What were the characteristics of those who survived? What he found was that the survivors associated to something different than a focus on death that helped them survive. 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death, the suffering that was inevitable. The people who survived developed a reason to survive. They created a meaning for their suffering rather than accepting their fate or wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they reframed it to construct a reason for surviving so that they could tell their story to their children, to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped them pull through the toughest of times. So, mindset mapping for growth simply means that our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us meaning and a running account of what happens, what it means, what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. Mindsets, frame an ongoing account of what we see, what we perceive, the stories we tell about our experience. For example, researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. In other words, the human brain operates much like a Google map. You see a situation or a circumstance, boom, you boot up a map that has the already existing associations, the patterns of feeling, thought, memory, behavior, attachment, and they get inactivated. So what this means is that we need to develop a story to have all of these images, all of these Google Maps fit together into a cohesive story, and to be aware of our states of mind and our mindsets. Now, a mindset is its own software program, complete, internally consistent. So the meaning determines your behavior. To change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. So here's an example of that, to look at fixed versus growth mindset. This is a very simple example, something that we coach toward, the growth mindset, in coaching. And if someone has a fixed mindset, that may be something we immediately address. And this is huge in navigating change and transition and coaching it. The view you adopt can significantly affect the way you live your life. So let's look at both of these. The growth mindset is based on a belief in change, that you can embrace change, you can develop yourself, you use it to adjust and grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have a special developed talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. The growth mindset is based on a belief that basic qualities are not there genetically, and it's not about talent, which is also a misnomer, but that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved throughout life. The fundamental assumption is that everyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. So let's look at a fixed mindset. This is something we may actively address in coaching. I want to give you some examples. Those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal can be to prove oneself in the classroom, in a career, in a relationship. A fixed mindset requires that proving over and over again, a confirmation of intelligence or personality or ability, and a repeated question internally may be, will I succeed or fail? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a loser or winner? Yet with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity and the need for proof. So here are some examples. A fixed mindset shares some of these characteristics. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem can include assigning blame or making excuses. So beliefs are often not conscious, yet we pay attention to them and hear them. Then we can change them. As mentor coaches, we can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. What can we learn from this? How can you improve? Here's an example of the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the 3-year period of study. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test score over those 3 years, equivalent to 8 years of normal aging. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It can reduce life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years, just by belief and regard. They lived into the belief that they had, or died into it. So, to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior, here is just some basic thoughts and principles, ones that you practice all the time, but I thought I'd list them anyhow. Begin with where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage their practice, to look, for example, at what has worked before, what they've done before in a similar situation. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus is going to enhance the neuronal etching, so it should be on what's worked, on positive experiences, useful feelings. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. And the client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences of their own story in order to do that. When we write a new story, change our minds, we change our brains. So we want to give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And we co-create with our clients the development of their story, their own metaphors, their connections, because stories, analogies, metaphors all create maps. So here's a summary of mentor coaching successful changes. We focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on looking at options and possibilities rather than advice or suggestions or ghostwriting a story. Since old patterns are already hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to evolve and change this wiring. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story, followed by recognition in order to understand and assess and change. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So let's review then some important elements in mentor coaching successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. And this is why people sometimes get stuck in therapy, because they explore the why, they explore all the reasons behind the problems. Every time you pursue a problem, it etches that old existing pathway in the brain even more. So somebody's going to know a lot about their problems, but not have addressed how to create a new experience, how to engage the possibility. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits, with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate state of mind and manage emotions to promote this process and focus on a new story. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. I want to come back to that in our discussion if we have time, because giving advice is what the coach and the client both want the coach to do. Think about when you began coaching. It was the hardest thing in the world not to give advice, opinions, or to camouflage a suggestion in the form of a question. Well, have you thought about, whenever you give advice or suggest an answer, it closes exploration. So it's more comfortable for coach and client for you to give an answer. Now, never mind that they're not going to take your suggestion, because that's not the way you create change, but temporarily it creates a closure and relatively more comfort. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery and to take ownership of that story. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy flow to the new ideas. Remember that power is in the focus and that permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes mind and brain. And finally, it may be helpful to conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process, to focus on and identify their story, and to help them internalize this process to revise the operating model of how and who they are, because this is what makes change permanent, that someone incorporates it as part of their working model of identity. If they simply make a change and don't address their core identity, they'll revert back to what they did before. So this is why we want to continually incorporate helping the client revise and transform the model of how and who they are while they're focusing on the surface or the behavioral or the other changes. So this is part of effectiveness and mastery as an evolving identity. So we're in conversation mode now, and if you'll manage the background noise, thoughts or questions that you'd like to discuss, or just clarifications of anything we've talked about. Is this useful to you? Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is Leia from New York.
Please, go ahead, yeah.
What you just mentioned about knowledge conveyed passively, could you give an example of knowledge that's conveyed passively as opposed to knowledge generated through insight?
Well, it would be anything that would have to do with just giving information, data, facts that we would hope would sort of catalyze change, but we, you know, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, we'd eat mostly vegetables, and librarians would be billionaires. So information is not enough. Any kind of passive knowledge is not enough. This is why I emphasize that what we're doing with a client is we become a catalyst to facilitate the development of their story. They got all kinds of information. They got Google. They have more information than they can use in a lifetime. But we're helping the client develop their own story. So, Leah, does that begin to address your question?
It does in a way. I'm still not so sure about the second point. Now,
tell me the rest of the question that didn't get answered.
What would be knowledge generated through insight? Like, what kind of knowledge can you, would the individual generate?
Okay. When someone has, in coaching we call it an aha moment, a moment of insight. Here's what happens. If someone is hooked up on an fMRI, and at the instant of insight, an aha moment, three different parts of their brain light up, and they're vaulted into a state that is more creative, more able to synthesize and integrate things. They're creating and generating a new experience, new thoughts and feelings, as opposed to that same fMRI and same person, when they're given data, information, facts, no part of the brain lights up. Nothing happens. So what we do in coaching that makes a difference is to help someone have insight, to self-reflect, to develop that ability to resonate with themselves, empathy with themselves about how they think and feel and experience, so that they're generating that, so that they have that experience with us, but it's an internal experience that they're continuing even the time we're not talking with them. So that's a part of the transformation of identity. At the same time, we're talking about a transformation of behavior or what they're doing. So it's a really important aspect of what we do as mentor coaches, I think. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you so much. That was
absolutely great. Yeah.
Okay.
I know we're out of time, but I'll hang on a minute or two. Any other thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to talk about or clarify?
This is Kip.
Hey, Kip, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
Super.
Just a quick review of MetaMap. Is that the principles of the neural conditioning chart?
I'm talking about that process in the neural conditioning chart and the master states of mind, but I'm also talking about helping someone conceptualize their own story so that they are able to develop that self-awareness and self-reflection as an ongoing process when they're not talking to us, so that they begin to self-reflect and look at what they're experiencing and putting together in a new way that extends and applies what we're doing, so that this process of self-awareness and self-reflection is developed and is ongoing. So the MetaMap is the concept, the reflection from a slightly different perspective than just experiencing it. They're also reflecting on it. It's the subjective and objective awareness combined. And it's what empathy is all about, to help someone develop empathy with themselves, not just for what they're feeling, but for how they think, what they're experiencing, what they're doing, to develop this self-awareness, to be aware of themselves and of their effectiveness, that whatever they think and feel and experience, they're creating that moment. So if they don't like it, then it's not up to anybody else. It's simply, what do you want to create now that you really want? So great question. Does that make sense, Kip?
Yeah, so it's self-compassion while doing deliberate practice, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to invite you to think about extending our final seminar for discussion, for more give and take and more things that you're interested in that I may not talk about or may not talk about enough. But we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very much for all of your input, for all the kind words and input you've had in emails. Keep those cards and letters coming. I look forward to picking up with you right here next week. So take good care of yourselves. Thanks again. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.